welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be talking with Nancy Cohen about the way that the sexual revolution backlash is causing political polarization. Also, not one, but two segments on the stunning introduction of the contraception controversy into the coverage of the Republican primaries. This budding 13-year-old feminist on YouTube just came to my attention, and I want to give her props.
Slut shaming is the unfortunate phenomenon in which people degrade or mock a woman because she dresses in tight or revealing clothing, enjoys sex, has sex a lot, or may even just be rumored to participate in sexual activity. The message that slut shaming sends to women is that sex is bad, having sex with more than one person is horrible, and everyone will hate you for having sex at all.
You go, girl. Seriously, I wish I was so smart at 13. The good news is that the mainstream media, confronted with Rick Santorum repeatedly noting that he wants to overturn Griswold versus Connecticut, has finally started to accept that perhaps there may just be some anti-contraception sentiment out there, generated by the anti-choice movement. The bad news is that, like with abortion, the entire focus is going to be on the legal right to buy it, without consideration for issues like access and affordability. This became clear when George Stephanopoulos asked this question at the New Hampshire Republican debate last weekend.
Governor Romney, I want to go straight to you. Senator Santorum has been very clear in his belief that the Supreme Court was wrong when it decided that a right to privacy was embedded in the Constitution. And following from that, he believes that states have the right to ban contraception. Now, I should add that he said he's not recommending that states do that.
Well, I'll be clear.
Okay. Absolutely. I'm giving you your due.
We're talking about 10th Amendment and the right of states.
But I do want to get to that core question. Okay. Governor Romney, do you believe that states have the right to ban contraception? Or is that trumped by a constitutional right to privacy?
Romney immediately deflected the question, which suggests to me that it's pretty toxic right now for anyone trying to get social conservative credentials to openly embrace contraception as a fundamental legal right. Instead, he addressed it as a question of state legislation.
George, this is an unusual topic that you're raising. States have a right to ban contraception. I can't imagine a state banning contraception. I can't imagine the circumstances where a state would want to do so. And if I were a governor of a state or a legislator of a state, I would totally and completely oppose any effort to ban contraception.
The thing is, he's not running for state government, nor is he running to be a legislator at all. He's running for president, which means an executive office. He wouldn't be crafting legislation, but he would be appointing Supreme Court justices. That means that his consideration of whether or not one has a right to privacy actually does matter. I don't know that we can be confident that if Griswold, which was the court decision that legalized contraception as a matter of privacy rights, was overturned, that means we wouldn't see some states at least severely restrict contraception. I could see, for instance, conservative states passing laws requiring you to be married or some such nonsense. I do get why Stephanopoulos gets frustrated with him, though, because Griswold and Roe were decided on exactly the same grounds, which is the right to medical privacy. If you accept the argument that Roe and other decisions also based in privacy, such as Lawrence v. Texas, should be overturned because there is no right to privacy, you have to accept that you'd extend the right to ban contraception to the states. Ron Paul tries to dodge the question in an even more entertaining way.
As far as selling contraceptives, the Interstate Commerce Clause protects this because the Interstate Commerce Clause was originally written not to impede trade between the states, but it was written to facilitate trade between the states. So if it's not illegal to import birth control pills from one state to the next, it would be legal to sell birth control pills in that state.
This is a disingenuous answer, since Paul supports bans on abortion, especially at the state level. If the Interstate Commerce Clause simply banned state and federal government from restricting any kind of economic activity, then that would apply to abortion as well as contraception. What's weird is that he has the Commerce Clause completely backwards. It actually gives the government the right to regulate commerce. It specifically states, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes, end quote. Paula is seeing a not that's not in there. The government has a right to ban the sale of all sorts of stuff as long as it doesn't interfere with an individual's basic rights. The question then was, do people have a right to sexual privacy? And the court said yes. What's ironic is that the anti-choice movement gets this in a way that people trying to be anti-abortion but pro-contraception don't. The legal right to contraception and the legal right to abortion are, constitutionally speaking, the same right. Rick Santorum is the only person who addresses this question that actually gets this.
Well, Congressman Paul is talking about privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment, which I agree with him in. I don't necessarily agree that the Patriot Act violates that, but I do agree with, obviously, we have a right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment, but that's not what the Griswold decision nor the Roe v. Wade decision were about. They created through a penumbra of rights a new right to privacy that was not in the Constitution.
I mean, the only thing he gets is that you can't separate Roe from Griswold. He's wrong about the creating rights thing. Conservatives like to throw the word penumbra around to make it sound all very scary, but all it really means is that you take the rights expressed in one part of the Constitution and the rights expressed in another and add them together to understand this new debate. A lot of your rights, when it comes to the justice system, are rooted in this penumbra, for instance. Privacy is something that's established not just under the Fourth Amendment, but the Third. There's no reason to think that a right expressed twice in the Constitution is somehow less valid than one expressed only once. While all this is very interesting, I would rather journalists address the nitty-gritty of the candidates' views on contraception. Ask them just not if they think it should be legal, but if they think it should be subsidized and covered as preventive care under healthcare regulations. I'd like to welcome Nancy Cohen to the program. Nancy is a historian, author, and contributor to the Huffington Post. Her new book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, tells the story of what Nancy has deemed the sexual counter-revolution and how it's polarizing our country. Welcome to RealityCast, Nancy.
Hi, Amanda. Great to be here.
So, as we're speaking, the Republican primary contest is going on across various states. Most of the mainstream discussion about it dismisses the idea that social conservatism is a major issue, at least this year, claiming that it's all about the economy instead. What do you say to that claim?
My answer to that is it's the sex stupid. The economy is, of course, on everybody's mind, but just because the economy is a big issue doesn't mean that these issues about gays and abortion and birth control are off the table. In fact, what's happened is all the candidates have actually already promised everything to the social conservatives. So they can be relatively quiet about it until they're pressed on it, like they were at the debate last Saturday night.
That whole incident was kind of amazing because I, you know, on this podcast, I've been talking forever and ever about the anti-choice movement's hostility to contraception. What do you make of the fact that they were finally asked about it in a debate format in like a mainstream area?
Well, I think it's a testament to the work you're doing and RH Reality Check does and a lot of other writers who are trying to point out what's really going on in American politics. So my concern is that it was so easily dismissed and that Romney weaseled out so easily of the debate. And, you know, I'm sure you saw that the post-debate coverage was how silly it was for Stephanopoulos and Sawyer to press them on this. So I think what happened is they started reading the press, the idea that, you know, someone like Santorum rising and bringing birth control on the table woke them up. And so they're starting to press on it, and I think that's a good thing.
So why do you think that this sexual counter-revolution, and I think, you know, obviously by that it's the moral majority, social conservatism, the religious right, all whatever term you want to use for it, why do you think it's so stubborn and so enduring? I mean, at this point, they're trying to roll back the clock 50 years.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's so stubborn because the majority of the Republican Party, the base of the Republican Party, got into politics exactly because of these issues. They got into politics in the 70s in a reaction against all these changes, the sexual revolution and feminism and gay rights, and they got political to try to stop it. They got political to try to roll back the clock to reverse history. You know, so they talk about restoring America, and they talk about taking back America. What they really want to do is take us back to a time when birth control and abortion and gay sex was illegal. And this is the essence of the Republican Party. It's not just some offshoot on the far right.
Can you talk a little bit more about this notion that the Republican base, at least like the evangelical base, was not that deeply political before? Because I think a lot of people don't understand that.
Yes, of course. So I think a lot of what we assume about American politics is a myth. And so one of those myths is how the right came into power and took control of the Republican Party. The right actually had no base, no voters, until after the sexual revolution. And it was rage about sex and about gays and about feminists and women's rights that mobilized a lot of voters who weren't even voting before, particularly fundamentalists. And these people got politically active because of these issues, and then they moved into the Republican Party and took it over.
Do you think that that goes a long way to explaining how we're seeing slipping enthusiasm for things like abortion rights over the years?
Well, we're actually not seeing much change in opinion on abortion. If you kind of look at the trend lines from the 1970s, you know, they fluctuate a few points, but they haven't really substantially changed. In about the mid to late 70s, Americans became overwhelmingly majority pro-choice, and it's remained that way. Now, obviously, there's a lot of chipping away at the edges, but it's the point that I want to make is that they're winning a lot of victories on these issues, even though they're a very small minority of voters. These people, I call them sexual fundamentalists because I think that's what's driving them. They make up about 17% of voters. They're outnumbered at least 3-1 in the general public. But what happens is they are the best political organizers in the country. And they stay tuned in. They stay involved in electoral politics even when they lose. And this is something that the rest of us don't do, frankly.
17%, do you feel, is that a number that has stayed steady over the years, or is it going up or going down?
It looks like it's going down. If you look at the demographics of these very conservative, very far-right social conservatives who are overwhelmingly religious conservatives, either Mormons or evangelicals or Catholics, they are overwhelmingly, they're getting much older, and they are much whiter than the general population. So just kind of simply the passage of time is making them a smaller proportion of the country. Now, there's still, you know, there's still a lot of evangelicals in the country. But it's important to note that a lot of evangelicals don't support the politics of these right-wing evangelicals.
When you say that they're better, they're just incredibly organized, why are they so good at this? Why are they so organized?
They know that power in America lies in control of the government. So in the 70s, after they defeated the Equal Rights Amendment, after they started running referendum campaigns to take civil rights away from gays, they started infiltrating the Republican Party. And they went in at the precinct level and at the state level, at the school board level, and they started changing the Republican Party from within. You know, the Republican Party used to be the pro-choice party. The Republican Party used to be the party of small government individual rights. After they took it over in the 80s and 90s, that's when the Republican Party started changing its positions on women's rights and choice and those kinds of issues. So they have an advantage, and this is probably key for people looking at our politics today. They stay involved in every election. They vote in Republican, state conventions. They vote in every midterm. They vote in every school board election. And so they stay involved there. The other secret weapon that they have is stealth. So when people see what they're doing and who they are, American voters recoil. I think that's part of why we're seeing the enthusiasm gap drop for Republicans right now, is we've watched them for a year, obstructing everything in Congress, spending their time legislating against birth control and abortion and doing nothing about jobs. So what happens is when they lose elections, they kind of go under the radar and they rebrand themselves as something else. And so their most recent rebranding is actually the Tea Party. The Tea Party is actually a little bit more than a front for the old Christian right.
Now, it's all very interesting to talk about Republicans, and I agree with, or I definitely see all that, what you're saying, but it's also worth pointing out that the Democrats throw them a bone periodically, too, like with this Plan B situation.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Democrats have their own sexual counter-revolution, and I tell that story in my book, Delirium. The Democrats' tendency to, taking the Plan B case, it's a kind of default position for Democrats when they're feeling weak or they're feeling, or they've lost election and they want to find some way to come back. Their default since 1972 has been to blame progressives, to blame their base, to blame gays, to blame women, to blame so-called elitists for alienating mainstream America. Okay? This is actually factually wrong. Now, if mainstream America really did disagree with all of these progressives, they might have a point. But the facts don't support this kind of Democratic Party line. And so the Plan B case of kind of evading the question but basically capitulating to the far right of the Republican Party is very much in line with this kind of self-defeatist Democratic narrative.
Why do you think they do that?
It goes back to, to get into the weeds a little bit, it goes back to McGovern's landslide defeat in 1972 when the party decided that they got trounced because of feminists and gays. And so every time they lose, they go back to that. Exit polls give them some support, but when you look at elections more deeply, it turns out that Democrats actually win elections by being supportive of socially liberal policies. So, for example, gay marriage actually had no effect on Bush's reelection. Democrats win elections for supporting abortion rights. It was a huge factor in Clinton's 1992 victory. But when they look at exit polls and they see things like the white working class deserting them, they assume that it's because the white working class is conservative. That's also a myth, but it's something that's really deeply ingrained in kind of the leadership of the Democratic Party to think that way.
So I guess one final question. Knowing what you do about the sexual counter-revolution and particularly the history of it, what advice would you give to those of us who are trying to push back to fight against them?
Good question. My main piece of advice would be don't despair. I think there's really good reason to hope that this can all change. I know it's been a really bad year, particularly for reproductive rights and for women's rights. So I think the job for writers and activists is to just keep plugging away to get the message out. And then the big change will come simply if everybody votes, right? If everybody votes, because these people are outnumbered very substantially, the sexual fundamentalists would lose the elections and our political delirium would end, and we would be able to move forward on the rights for all these people that we care about.
Well, my guest today has been Nancy Cohen, and her book is titled Delirium: How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. You can buy it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Nancy.
Thanks, Amanda. Great to be with you. I got love for you if you were born in the
80s, the 80s. You didn't think I was just going to leave the whole contraception exchange at the New Hampshire debate to one segment, did you? I mean, I've spent years now trying to get people to open their eyes and see what's going on with the anti-choice movement coming after birth control, and finally, it's getting some mainstream attention. This is exciting stuff, though sadly it's only happening because the right is finally pushing so hard that it's impossible to avoid this question. Up with Chris Hayes had a segment featuring friend of this show, Erin Carmone, whose own work exposing the anti-contraception bent of the anti-choice movement has caused some feather ruffling in the Beltway. Erin defended herself from critics who whined about her characterizing Rick Santorum as coming for your birth control and claiming that she was basically being hysterical.
Pursued the case about whether Rick Santorum is or is not coming for your birth control.
Frankly, I think any one of the prongs of his opposition to birth control is enough. It's sufficient to say he's coming for your birth control, not to get Clinton asked about what coming for means, right. And not to...
Be showing up at your door, right. Knocking right. On it, presumably. It is, yeah.
Right, but if that's the bar, come on. Right. I think he would like to see that world. Whether he thinks it's feasible is another thing. But it's not an academic question, right? Griswold, I mean, that is something that when Robert Bork said that was wrongly decided, that was really enough to get him out in terms of a Supreme Court nominee. It's not just Roe v. Wade, it's also Lawrence versus Texas, it's also the
Lawrence versus Texas, of course, the sodomy case, yes.
Striking down sodomy laws, which we all know how Rick Santorum feels about sodomy.
Right.
So there's...
That's awkward, but yes.
Yeah. Continue, keep it going.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm getting in trouble. So there's that, right? But then there's also really concrete policy questions that are not just historical, right, and not theoretical about what kind of Supreme Court justices he would appoint. They have to do with, for example, defunding Planned Parenthood, which the federal money goes to contraceptive services for low-income women, which Rick Santorum and many of the other Republican candidates, including Mitt Romney, want to do. It also is, opposing the fact that the Affordable Care Act has coverage for contraception. It's now going to be fully covered once this goes into effect. They oppose that. Not being able to afford contraception is the same thing as not having access to contraception. I mean, if they really want to lower the abortion rate.
Right.
I think this is an important thing to consider. Far too many Beltway journalists have decided that unless an immediate ban on all forms of contraception is within the realm of the possible, it's unfair to warn the public that the anti-choice movement is gunning for contraception. But that's a really silly way to look at it. After all, we know that anti-choicers are happy to work piecemeal. They may want to end the use of contraception altogether in the U.S., but if they can't have that immediately, they will chip away at access. And low-income women are the first attacked, in no small part because they have less power and few defenders. If someone is coming after your birth control and they only have 50% success, that's still completely terrible and counter to all public health and basic common sense goals. The panel went on to talk about Mitt Romney's non-answer, where he pretended that he didn't know that there was a big-time Supreme Court decision in 1965 allowing legal contraception.
First of all, I love Stauffenopoulos saying, hold on
a second.
You went to Harvard Law, which is an aspect you will notice of the Mitt Romney bio that does not get a ton of play in Mitt Romney ads, for instance. But I also thought it was an incredibly Weasley answer by Romney.
Part of the problem is that because Romney went to Harvard Law, he knows full well that there's no way to parse the problem of opposing Roe while supporting Griswold, since they were fundamentally decided on the same grounds. During this segment, I learned something I didn't really know before about Mitt Romney, a factoid that makes his claim to be ignorant of Griswold and its impact sound even more fishy.
He's got Bork as the co-chair of his Judicial Advisory Committee.
Oh, that's a good detail. Bork is the co-chair of the Mitt Romney Judicial Advisory Committee, Robert Bork, who opposed Griswold and, of course, was deemed far too extreme.
Rachel Maddow also covered the new focus on contraception and the problems that it's creating for the candidates. For instance, Rick Santorum in the past has been upfront about his belief that contraception is wrong and no one should be using it. But Rachel confronted him during the commercial break when he was doing a live radio show, and suddenly he's being dodgy.
He said that you've been mischaracterized on that. Do you think that the country would be better off if there was less contraception use? You talked, I saw you talk today about what people, the liberty that people should do, what they ought to do, not what they want to do.
I talked about a Brookings Institute study that said that, as 2009 study, said if you do three things, you're almost guaranteed not to be in poverty.
Rob, let me know more about
it. And those three things are, number one, work, right? Makes sense, work. Number two, graduate from high school. And number three, if you're a man, get married. If you're a woman, get married. Don't have a child before you're married. Get married and don't have a child before you're married. If you don't do one of those three things, the poverty rate is 74%.
Okay, well, most people who want to wait until they're married to have kids use contraception for that purpose. Something like pretty much all of them, except for a couple of religious nut outliers. Santorum is trying basically to argue that contraception somehow causes out-of-wedlock births. Man, I hate that term. But because it lets people think they can have sex and then they go get pregnant. Luckily for us, we actually have data to disprove this argument and not just common sense. The record high for teen pregnancy was not 1966, the year after Griswold was decided, nor was it after condoms became ubiquitous in the 80s and 90s. It was actually 1958, when it was twice as high as it is now. True, there were a lot of shotgun marriages back then, but so what? The difference is not in contraception use, but in mores regarding marriage and pregnancy. The only discernible effect that contraception has had on so-called out-of-wedlock births is that it lowered the rate of them. It seems that the anti-choice movement has put the Republican candidates in between a rock and a hard place. As Romney's dithering shows, they can't come out and support contraception rights, much less do something like say contraception should continue to be subsidized by the government. If candidates do that, the religious right will turn on them. But they can't openly pander to the religious right by stating in mainstream spaces that they're going to fight against contraception access, because that's going to alarm anyone who is a potential general election voter, as well as tons of moderate Republicans. After all, like most of the country, most Republicans use contraception and aren't going to like hearing that lambasted. Seems like the anti-choice radicalism is becoming quite the albatross. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, the abortion is blamed for everything edition. Right Wing Watch got audio of Christian minister Lou Engel blaming abortion for bad weather.
The Joplin tornado came last year. Three tornadoes in one, rumbling through the land. I said right after that to my friends, this is the beginning of God's redemptive judgments for the shedding of innocent blood of the unborn. This is a sign God separating the nation on the issue of abortion.
This is why I get so angry at people who dismiss the abortion wars as being a matter of both sides being to blame for how ugly everything is. Look, one side is arguing that women's reproductive rights are good for women, for families, and for society. The other side is arguing that abortion causes God to send tornadoes. There's no equivalence here. The antis aren't even playing with reality-based materials here.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.